Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today, I have an amazing guest named Onika Mays. And many of you know that in season 10, my intention is really to focus on the eight limbs of yoga as kind of a regulatory framework for the mind, the heart, the nervous system. And I have a few special guests because there's just certain people that when they come across your path and you get the opportunity to interview them, you just have a feeling inside that that's a person you need to connect with. And so I was sent a copy of Onika Mays' book. And when I started to read this book, I felt something deep, deep inside about needing to help her give the message that she's about to give you today. And I really think, especially in these times with all that we're going through, I actually think you need to go out and buy the book. I really think you need to go buy the book. It's not an easy read, not because it's not beautifully written. It is beautifully written, but what you will read in there is not easy to read, meaning it is a detailed explanation of what is happening in our prison system and our prison industrial complex, and how someone who's coming in to offer meditation and mindfulness and yoga, how do they function in that type of system? I think the reason why it's so important for us to read this is not just for the, you know, prison industrial complex that we've had all these decades and decades, but the fact that we're starting to build more warehouses to house more people all over the United States. I think it's something like 36 huge warehouses are being built right now. I think we need to know what's going on in these places so that we can collectively decide this is not who we are as a society. This is not who we are as people. And we actually are not going to let this happen. So please stay with the interview. Onika is lovely. There's beautiful, beautiful things being said. And there's an action that we all will be asked to take in the upcoming years. And that action is to say, no, we're not going to allow human beings to be dehumanized. And we're not going to be cruel to our fellow humans. And that if we collectively say that together, there is safety in numbers. We can do this together. All right, let's go meet Onika and have this wonderful conversation. Welcome. Whether this is your first time listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour, or you've been with us for an entire 3 years, we just want to say that we are ready to go deeper now. This year, we'll be studying the eight limbs of yoga with a variety of guests, and we hope you enjoyed this season. Let's go meet our guest now. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Onika. So glad you're here.
I'm so happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
Onika, you've had a big week. What happened this week?
My book came out and it has just been a wonderful ride so far. So yeah, I'm so happy to be here to talk to you that my book is out.
I know. It's called Sit With Me by Onika Mays. And we're going to be talking all about it today. And is this your first book?
It is my first book.
Okay. The first thing I want to say to everybody who's listening is, you're an amazing writer, like a better writer than 99.999% of the people. It's really, really well written. Is that just a natural skill that you have? I've read in your book that you have been an avid reader your whole life, but...
Thank you. I'm pausing because... Wow. Thank you so much. I think I've always wanted to be a writer, and I've always written in secret. And I wrote a lot of Facebook posts around this work that I was doing. And I've written screenplays before, nothing that got published yet. But I think I've always wanted to be a writer, but this was my first attempt at really like staking claim and saying I am a writer. So this was my first like go at it professionally.
The thing that struck me is how you were able to bring us into your life going in and out of Rikers prison. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like I knew the people that you were talking about, and I was sitting there with you in the classes, or sitting with you looking out the window, smelling that breath of fresh air with someone who was in the prison. It was really striking. If anyone wants to know what it's like, you really did a beautiful job of just giving all these very fine details and sensory input.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That really means a lot. I'm really touched by that, because Rikers is a terrible place, and I want everybody to experience what it was like. I can't bring everybody inside. So this was my way of attempting to do that, attempting to bring people in to see what it was like. I used to try to do that when I was a volunteer, and I would write posts about the classes that I would teach. But, you know, that's a short form, you know, a little piece of work that you're doing. So this was a way for me to really dig in and expose everything, myself, the place. And I think what I really struggled with was to make sure that I was doing justice to people's stories, because I didn't want to seem like I was exploiting people's stories. So I was really trying to keep the focus on me and honor the folks who I sat with. I'm really glad that you got what I was attempting to do. So that means a lot. So thank you.
No, I felt it. I'm a very sensitive person, and I didn't expect to feel so deeply. By the time I got to the end, I was like, whoa. we'll get there. Let's start at the beginning. Let's say that first you were a volunteer that would go a couple times a week. But then at some point you became the mindfulness coach, meditation teacher at Rikers full time.
Yes. I volunteered for many years, over 6 years, with a nonprofit. And then I was asked to interview for this position of mindfulness coach. And at the time, I was told it was part-time. And I thought, okay, sure, this is great. Because, you know, I was a yoga teacher and I was working part-time at a nonprofit as a director of operations. You know, as a yoga teacher, you have like 8 jobs. And so I was like, okay, this is just going to be one more part-time job. But it seemed wonderful to be able to do this work a little bit more meaningfully. And the interview was really intense. There was like a panel interview of 5 people, and it was extensive. And I was like, this seems like a lot for a part-time job. And then I got this offer that it was full-time. And it was overwhelming. It's like, whoa, I'm going to have this full-time job to help launch a wellness program alongside an acupuncturist and a wellness coach in the women's facility on the island. And that just seemed like a really incredible opportunity. So I worked full-time at Rikers Island. I was employed by New York Health and Hospitals under their agency called Correctional Health Services. So New York Health and Hospitals is the medical provider for everybody on Rikers Island. So that was my employer. And we launched this thing that had never been done before, creating a wellness program for people who were in the women's facility at Rikers.
The first thought that comes to mind, I'm sure with a lot of yoga teachers and yoga therapists, is, oh my gosh, she got a full-time job. She has probably benefits and like a real salary on the first of the month. And what I think people probably won't figure out until they read your book is how you earned every penny of that and more. I mean,
Your reaction was my exact reaction. A very decent salary, benefits, pension, you know, because I was a city employee, and all of the perks that come with being a city employee. And then also instantly, at the same moment, I had a pang of guilt. Going in as a volunteer with an organization and going inside a place like Rikers Island into the sort of the belly of the beast of oppression and white supremacy, I felt distance. There was distance there because I wasn't a part of it. But now I would be a part of it because I would be an employee. I would be taking a salary. And instantly it didn't sit right. But I was like, I know what I'm going to do. And the doctors who had, you know, piloted this program were incredible people, like just incredible. And I can't say enough good things about the folks that I worked with and the freedom that they gave me just to do what I thought was right for my part of the program. But there was always that conflict inside me that I'm collecting a salary and I get holidays and, you know, I have a pension and a 401k and all of these things that are helping to uphold this horrible system. And I never forgot that. There wasn't one minute that wasn't also living inside me.
There was one part in the book where I think one of the guards said, "Hey, you don't go do what all the inmates are doing. You come over here. You're one of us. You're not one of them." And that really touched me that you had that reaction with, what do you mean there's separation? Like somehow they're at a different tier. You know, obviously there is a hierarchy because you're employed and you're in charge and responsible, but almost like dehumanizing of, oh, you don't belong in that line.
Oh, yes. It's everywhere. It's from the moment that you get there. And that happened when I was a volunteer. And I think that was my first taste, you know, being a Black woman and being queer. I'm very aware of my body in the world. I'm very aware of, you know, as comfortable as I am in my skin, I know what it's like to be Black in the United States of America. And in that moment, when I was a volunteer, I was actually leaving and I was in line and there were visitors who were like trying to get on the bus. And an officer told me not to wait with them because I was different. I was like, is this what it's like be handed like white privilege? Because this person was telling me, you aren't them. You are one of us and you stand here. And his voice changed and he was kind and he called me sweetheart. Like it was a shift. The ickiness inside me, I couldn't get home fast enough and just shower because I was like, this is awful. Like, this is awful. And the way the bus would even pull up to let employees get on first, that started to end after a while. You know, I'd been going there for over a decade, so I saw that things changed. But for a long time, the bus would pull up and let employees on first, and then people who were visiting would get on second. So there was always this play on hierarchy, whether you were a visitor, whether you were a volunteer, whether you were, you know, a civilian or whether you were an officer, you were always very aware of who you were in that place.
Yeah. So all of what you just said kind of brings me to something. I think you had the realization that maybe this is one of your quotes, the real problem is us. So can you say a little bit more what you mean about that? Like,
yeah,
this is a symptom, but we are actually the problem.
Yeah, society is the problem. Rikers is a symptom of our society, I believe. If you've read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, and for folks who haven't, I encourage you to please pick it up and read it. It gives you a wonderful, detailed academic history of mass incarceration in this country. And a lot of people say, like, the system is broken. And the system isn't broken. It's working as it's designed. Incarceration, as we know it now, was actually rooted in slave catching. So it's working as it's designed. And when we realize that we have a lot of power as people, and we say, this is not okay, we cannot treat each other like this. Systems start to crumble. We're seeing this happen right now in real time. We are seeing.
I live in Minneapolis. Oh. I'm right here. I'm loving this. I'm loving what you're saying.
So systems can crumble when we recognize that we have the power to crumble them. And that is what I started to realize. Like, this place isn't the problem. This place is just a symptom of the problem. If I stand with someone and I'm not afraid because I can stand with my neighbor, the system will topple.
We just saw it. The people of Minnesota said no.
You said no.
No. And I guess I'm a little fearful that it happened in Minneapolis because we had George Floyd here. We learned from that. I have this, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think people didn't want to see themselves as the type of people that let George Floyd happen. Which that in itself is kind of icky, but let's move past that for a minute and say that it is genuine care for our neighbors that we want to care of people. I feel like it happened in a pocket here, but I don't know if our collective consciousness throughout the whole United States is ready to shift.
Even going back to what you said, I think it's important because I don't think we have to go past it. Because if you think about what the Buddha said about the two guardians, moral shame and fear of consequences, right?
Yeah.
That's okay.
It's okay, good.
But the Buddha even said that. We do things because we are afraid of the consequences of what other people will think. We do things because it's the right thing to do because we don't want to feel ashamed inside. We don't want the consequences of what other people are going to think about us if we do the wrong thing. There is loving accountability there that I think drives us. Shame by itself is not a terrible thing. It keeps us from doing stupid stuff. You know, my dad always used to say, don't act the fool. You know, that's okay. And we can get to places differently. But once we're there, you know, I don't think we have to always be on the same page. If we can all get to that same place and we're centering humanity, that can be enough.
Okay, well, I do think we're getting there.
I do. And I don't think everybody's going to come. I don't think that. I am a believer that, you know, Harriet Tubman left people behind and we are going to leave some people behind. And that's the way things work. And it's always been that way. But there's more of us, I think, who care than don't. I think there's more of us who, even on an individual level, having conversations, see the humanity in each other's eyes. And even if in a mob, they have hate one-on-one, it's really hard to maintain that.
It's true.
It's really hard. You know, I have a friend who is Black and she's a farmer, like the next farm over, our big MAGA people. And yet they need to share equipment and tools. And on an individual level, there is an ability for us to still remember that we have an ability to connect. And we are going to have to because systems are crumbling left and right and a new way is coming.
I know that. I mean, on some level, it's terrifying what's coming with AI and the shift in, you know, everything, the whole global order. But in some way, I also feel a relief that maybe we can build something new.
Yes.
Together, collectively.
Yeah. And change is scary. You know, I mean, that happened to me when I was in that hot yoga class and a teacher said, you can change or be comfortable, but you can't do both at the same time. You know, and I knew that, okay, if I was going to change my life, it was going to be really uncomfortable. I mean, nothing easy is comfortable. You know, it's not.
So is that part of how you help people who lived in Rikers get the liberation from the inside?
You know, I don't know. I think I let go a lot of what I thought I was doing early on. And it wasn't about me. It was about the conversations that I could have with people and just talk about what I knew. And if they felt that it was useful, that they could take what they needed and leave what they didn't want. I know when I first wanted to teach metta inside, I had a real fear of teaching the difficult person. I thought that it would be too triggering. I thought that, oh, you know, people are going to feel bad if they're talking about like the difficult person because they've either hurt somebody or somebody's hurt them and it's not going to feel right and all of these different things. And then I realized that was actually all about me and all about my stuff. And I didn't want to be rejected if I taught something that they didn't like. And that was actually really stingy for me to hold back. Who am I to hold back a teaching from the Buddha? So it's to leave the teachings up to people to decide. And I can take it. If I teach you something, you're like, this is stupid, or I don't like this, or this isn't resonating with me. Okay, then that's okay. I don't have to take that personally. And that's that person's experience. And that can be it. And so realizing that that kind of thinking was infantilizing to people and it was condescending, I had to call back to this wonderful essay by Rachel Naomi Remen, Helping, Fixing, and Serving. And I was seeing people as broken with that kind of thinking rather than serving and seeing them as whole.
Wow. Inside or outside of Rikers, that's such an important thing to remember, that we can just offer it and they may or may not enjoy it. Did you find a lot of pushback, or were people more willing to at least try it on for size?
Since the program was voluntary, everybody who came signed up to try it. There were some people who tried it once and didn't like it. There were some folks who would try practices with and they didn't like, you know, yoga, or they didn't like meditation. And so we would do other things. And it was all about offering whatever I could offer so people would have multiple tools. And once I realized it wasn't personal, and it wasn't about being liked. And I say this all the time, like, it wasn't about liking me. And I say this in the book, like, I don't even consider myself particularly likable. And that's not me fishing for anything. It's just, you know, I would really rather focus on unconditional love and focusing on centering humanity and causing the least amount of harm in the world. Like, that is far more important than whether, like, you like me or not. Like, can we be in community together and can we love each other, I think, is more important. If you don't like me, that's cool. That's okay. You know, there's plenty of people. I don't like
it
most
may not
people.
Be their cup of tea. Right?
Yeah. I don't like a lot of people. I mean, you just look outside and see what's going on. There's not a lot to like out there, but that can't stop me from not loving people. Right. Mm. That can't stop it. I mean, even Mother Teresa said, like, if you're judging people, you have no room to love them. And I think that's part of the same thing.
How do you reconcile this loving kindness with, like, justified anger about the state of the United States and racism and white mm-hmm. supremacy?
I think that anger is a part of love, right? I think that metta gets a really bad rap because I think a lot of people think that loving kindness or this idea of unconditional love is like a form of toxic positivity. And it isn't. Metta is unconditional love. That doesn't mean a free pass. It doesn't mean like you're being a doormat. It's actually a very sort of full, actionable kind of love. It's very rich and it embraces the totality of life and of life's experiences, which leaves room for righteous anger. It leaves room for calling people in. It leaves room for calling people out when they're causing harm, yourself included in that. So I think there's plenty of room for all of that, especially around, you know, holding space for difficult people. Holding space for difficult people doesn't mean that you don't fight against what's going on in the world. It actually is an act of love to stop people from causing harm.
Let's take just a little pause and talk about something that's really exciting. I teach at the University of Minnesota. There is something called the Bakken Center for Spirituality and Healing. And we are doing some groundbreaking work over there. We offer these classes 3 times per year, once in April, a 4-week session, also in July, a 4-week session, and again in October, another 4-week session. These classes offer an opportunity to study yoga therapy within this university environment that values rigorous inquiry, evidence-informed practices, and respect for the ancient wisdom traditions. Each of our courses at the University of Minnesota Bakken Center for Spirituality is designed to help you understand how yoga can influence your nervous system, support emotional regulation, and contribute to integrative health and well-being. Whether you're a healthcare provider seeking new tools, or a yoga teacher or yoga therapist who is expanding their practice, or a lifelong learner interested in the science of yoga practice, these classes provide a structured and supportive way to deepen your skills. We'll have one series on low back and hip pain, another one on upper back and neck pain, and a third one on insomnia and anxiety. We hope to see you over at the University of Minnesota. Your participation strengthens the growing community of professionals who are redefining what care can look like in modern healthcare and education. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Have you always been like this, that people didn't like you?
No. I was completely obsessed with being liked. I still feel deeply insecure lots of the time. Maybe a lifelong thing that I deal with. And I think that may be because I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood and I felt sort of on the outside a lot. Even though I had like a lot of friends, I wasn't somebody who didn't have a lot of friends. And I think a lot of people who will read this book who knew me growing up will be very surprised at some of the things that I'm saying.
Who is this woman?
Because I was fairly popular, you know, I was able to fit in, but I masked a lot of my insecurity by making sure that I was outgoing, making sure that I was likable, making sure that I could maneuver through lots of different things. And that over time wore me down and made me angry. It made me bitter. It made me distant. And then I became mean, I think, when I got a little bit older, especially as my career started to take off. And I don't think I was very kind. I don't believe in nice. Yeah, I wasn't kind. I know I wasn't kind. I was actually mean as a way to just protect myself because I was frankly exhausted.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't see that. That in giving too much and being too sweet and gentle and letting our boundaries be stomped all over, we have no choice but to go into survival mode and tell people to back off politely or impolitely.
Yeah.
So there's so many things I want to ask you about, but was it possible to create a sacred space? You had kind of a trailer that was backed up to the prison that people would come, and you were doing some one-on-one privates and yoga nidra, yoga classes. Was it possible to make that space sacred?
I think I made the space as sacred as I could. I would leave the house in the morning and I would call on my ancestors to come with me every morning and to just walk with me from the moment that I left, like, you know, through my entire commute into my office. And I would do Reiki on the walls before I got the day started. And I mean, I obviously couldn't burn sage, but I actually had liquid sage that I would spray and aromatherapy. And so it felt as good as it could feel. And I think that people could feel the difference. There was definitely an energetic feel. People used to like to come into the office. Even officers would wander by.
And you had windows.
So yeah.
Fresh air in.
Yeah. The side of my trailer. So the trailer was connected to the jail. So there was like a walkway. And where my office was, there was a window that looked out onto a yard. So there wasn't anything there but just sort of grass. And my window would only open about 3 or 4 inches, but you could even open the window a bit, especially when they were cutting grass. I would keep it open because you could smell the fresh cut grass.
I mean, it sounds strange, but a luxury for someone who get to have open windows and smell fresh cut grass.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because most of the windows in Rikers obviously didn't open. So it was like being in a giant airplane all of the time with just this used air just circling around, and the smell, like Rikers has a smell because the air is just so old and just circulating all of the time. I would smell it on me when I would leave. Oh, the first thing I would do is like walk into my apartment and just take everything off.
And I'm also curious, were there a lot of like loud sounds, or was it a space where people could get into a very quiet moment with themselves, or was there just constant noise all around?
I was fortunate. Our trailer was called the West Corridor Clinic. So it was actually acquired a part of the jail. There was a main clinic, which was usually pretty wild. And our clinic had mindfulness, acupuncture, wellness. There was a chronic illness doctor. And there were 2 intimate partner violence counselors and then 2 methadone counselors. And we had a really nice relationship with everyone there. And people always said that the West Corridor Clinic felt pretty good. Occasionally stuff would go down because it's still Rikers. I mean, it's still Rikers Island. So fights would happen, stuff would happen. I saw a lot of stuff there, but for the most part, it could be pretty relaxing and people would come and they would fall asleep.
Yeah, like that's such, I think at one point, you know, had this feeling of, wow, they must really trust you if they can come and fall asleep. I'm having a side conversation in my head right now because it kind of sounds like, oh, this wonderful place, you get yoga and acupuncture. And it wasn't that, right? We need to
And yes, and that was part of my problem, right? Like when our program started, it was disruptive, right? Because it was brand new. And when things are new, especially in a place as big as Rikers, and you bring in something new, everybody hates it. Because Rikers is a machine, you know, like a hospital or a school. Everything works, you know, on a system, on a clock. It's very militarized. So when you start something new, everybody's complaining. Officers have to do new things. The nurses have to do new things. And everybody was complaining about it. That's great because it's disruptive. So that means something's getting broken. And that's good. That's what you want to have happen. And then everybody started to really like it, which is wonderful too. But things can't stay disruptive forever. At some point, because the system is so big, it gets absorbed.
Yeah.
So it was no longer this wonderful disruptive thing, and it just became another part of what makes Rikers run. And it becomes a part of the machine. And so I think on a macro level, since it was no longer disruptive, it wasn't doing what I maybe hoped that I thought I would be doing. And on a micro level, of course, individually, I was still, you know, serving people and delivering care. I think I had naively thought that I might be able to break the system a little bit, but you can't. You can't break something that's working so well. And then I even realized that I was making Rikers look a little bit more palatable, right? Because Onika's teaching mindfulness and yoga, and then there's an acupuncturist, and then there's a wellness coach. So how bad could it be? And it is still bad, but their perception could appear to be that it's not as bad. And then I couldn't sit with that. That started to really bother me, coupled with the compassion fatigue that was sitting in, coupled with a lot of the stuff that had taken place inside the facility I was working in post-COVID, coupled with just the deteriorating conditions. And I was doing a great job rationalizing everything as I was going in, but it became harder and harder to rationalize. And I was like, I don't think I'm helping anymore. I think I'm hurting people. I don't think I'm eliminating harm. I think I might be contributing. And that's when I had to really have an honest conversation with myself. Is this something you can continue doing?
I think that point in the book really surprised me. And this idea of, when do you get to choose yourself over a machine that's going to just keep going and going, regardless of what you do? If you stay or go, doesn't matter. That machine is just going to keep munching along. And you have to decide if you're going to be part of that and get eaten up by it, or if you're going to choose yourself and say, I have this one precious life and I have Dharma, I have life purpose, and this may or may not be it.
And metta teaches us, you know, I think about when Sharon Salzberg gives the example of her teacher asking her if somebody like came in, and might be paraphrasing here, but somebody comes in and says that you have to choose between killing yourself or who's going to die at the table or something like that. And you have to choose. And you're like, well, I guess I would have to choose myself, but you shouldn't be able to choose anybody because you should matter as much as everybody else. And I think that is where my metta practice came in. I couldn't matter less than the people that I was serving. And that is the number one place where I realized, like, oh, I am really living metta, because before I was really justifying saying, like, no, I need to keep doing this because I'm doing this for other people. And then I was like, I'm really struggling. And I felt guilty because I was struggling, because I'm not incarcerated, but it was really taking a toll on me physically. But how could I even be delivering care if I'm really starting to suffer as much? And if I'm supposed to matter as much as other people, at some point, it would only be right to pull myself out, because then I would be causing even more harm to other people if I wasn't taking care of myself. And that is something that I think we all need to understand, that taking care of yourself is not just a luxury, right? That Audre Lorde quote, it's an act of self-preservation, and it's absolutely necessary.
I agree with all that. And yet there's like this little shame monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you have the privilege to have a choice. Whereas maybe the people in the jail, they don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I have to come to terms with that, that my privilege is allowing me the choice to put myself on the same level as everyone else that I want to care for. Mm-hmm. Did you have any of that?
I did struggle with that. And then I had to really look at it in terms of care. And if I'm not well delivering care to people, I'm hurting people.
Yeah. And that mask of I'm going to come in and I'm going to mask up and try to make it okay for you for this 30 minutes or something. I don't know energetically if that works anyway.
Oh, it doesn't. And especially in a place like a jail where people smell BS instantly, it doesn't even work. Inauthenticity is sniffed out. It's not something that you could get away with.
Was that scary to know that anytime you went maybe to a place of protection or survival or inauthenticity, that it was going to get sniffed out and probably pointed out?
No, I think I reckoned with that when I was a volunteer.
Oh, okay.
I became comfortable when I was a volunteer and I became really seen. I was having a conversation with somebody just a few weeks ago about this. And I remember when I was a volunteer, I taught a group class and there was a woman who was sitting in the back. She didn't take class, but she was watching. And after class, she waved me over and said, "Can I talk to you for a second?" I said, "Oh, sure." So I sat down. She was actually making what they call jail sushi, had a plastic wrap, and she had like tuna, and she had made this roll, and she was just doing this intricate cooking as we're talking. And she said, "I can see that something really terrible happened to you when you were a child, but you really look like you've healed from it. And it's just really wonderful to see you teaching these classes because you just really like quite a light." And I felt very naked and exposed because I realized that my heart was wide open. I don't know what she sniffed out on me, but I was just very open. And for a half a moment, I was like, "Oh, I've been caught. I've been found out." And at the same time, I was really proud of myself because that was not something that I was used to doing, or not having somebody call it out to say, like, "I see you," like, so clearly. Yeah. So that was a moment very early on in this work that I was like, it's okay to just be myself. I was more myself at Rikers than I ever was in the world. And I think because of that experience, I show up as myself in most places. And it just feels really good not to hide.
I don't think we can understate how vulnerable that can feel. And yet, at least in the jail, it sounds like you didn't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that not having a choice and just letting your heart be out there, being authentic, actually transferred back into your life outside the jail.
Yeah. And it worked for me. I'm not saying that everybody at Rikers worked like that, but I think because of the work that I did, it was the only way that I knew that I could do this work. And I think I even mentioned in the book that, I mean, I was connecting with people early on when I was, you know, a full-time employee, and there was an officer who wanted to let me know that somebody that I was working with just got convicted of something that was pretty awful and made it really clear and brought a newspaper article about this person and said, "I just want to let you know, like, here's who, you know, you're being so nice to," and put the article about them on my desk. And I was like, I know what they're convicted of. And the look on his face. And I would be just as kind to you if you were convicted of something. I am not here to judge what anybody did. That means I don't have anything to do with that. I have to treat people wholly. And I would hope that you would treat me wholly if I were here under those circumstances. And he just looked at me like, well, that wouldn't happen. But
yeah, I have another friend who teaches in a jail and had a similar thing happen. And I think it was really hard for her to possibly bring the love together with the fact that this person had committed these atrocities, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get there? That it's,
I hadn't
have the wholeness of that.
I had a lot of lessons when I was a volunteer. I think volunteering prepped me a lot to be there full time in some ways. I was volunteering in the men's jail. It wasn't at Rikers, but it was in the Manhattan Detention Complex. And there was somebody that we were teaching a class. It was the protective custody housing. And there was somebody who was accused of some pretty horrific stuff. And he came to our class. And we were teaching a chair yoga class. And during our shavasana, somebody came up to him and whispered something into his ear. And it was obviously threatening because you could see his whole demeanor change. I could just see the fear on his face. And I knew, I was like, oh, we're going to leave here. And this guy is just going to get beat up. And these officers are not going to do anything because of what he's here for. And at that moment, he wasn't a guy who was accused of whatever. He was a guy who I knew was going to get beat up pretty badly. And there was nothing I could do about it. There was nothing I could do about it. And just know that he was going to get hurt. And that changed something in me. And I was like, if I'm going to do this work, I can't be full of it. I can't decide. I can't pretend. I'm going to have to love people completely or just not do this work anymore. Like, it was a fork in the road for me. It was either you are going to have to love this guy and everybody else like him. You don't have to like him.
Yeah.
And you can be very grateful he's here and not out there. Yeah. But you are going to have to love him. And that's the only way. And I was really uncomfortable. And at the same time, I was like, this is the only way you can go forward.
What does loving him mean to you?
It means recognizing that he's a human being. And every human being, we don't know what we're capable of. And I can say that really honestly. We don't know what we're capable of. I know a lot of people say, I could never. You don't know what you're capable. You don't know what you're capable of.
No.
You don't know. You just don't know in what circumstances. It was that moment I was like, okay, this is a big one. And it shifted a lot for me. It healed something in me too, just because of my own background of abuse. It healed something in me. I unhooked from something in that moment too. And I felt a little free, honestly.
It sounds to me like if you can love this person knowing that any of us might have done the same with a similar upbringing and the traumas and trials of life that happened to them, that we might do something similar, I would think it would open up a space for a little bit more self-love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's work, right? You and I are having this conversation, but, you know, we are talking years. We're talking years of practice. This isn't that I don't get angry. It's not that I don't get frustrated. You know, I'm watching what's happening in the world right now, just in disbelief, you know, hearing that's everything that's going on with the Epstein files. I'm like scratching my head. You know, I have a lot of anger. And yet, if we don't start to center people and center the earth, taking care of the earth and each other, we aren't going to make it. I mean, we don't make it out of this alive, but, you know, we have got to figure out a new way to be together.
Yeah, we have to. Absolutely. So what is your favorite message from the book? Have you already said it, or is there something more that is like you want to gift us so that as we build this new collective consciousness that's emerging, that like, here's the thing I want y'all to take to bed with you tonight and pray on or meditate on, or
that it starts with you. We think it's out there.
Yeah.
We think all the answers are out there. We think our wellness is out there. We think the right teacher is out there, but it starts with loving ourselves. We don't even have to like every part of ourselves to love ourselves.
Yeah.
And when we can do that, we can start to really be free, you know? And then it's like what Toni Morrison says, it's like, once you're free, it's your job to free somebody else, you know? And then you can do that. You don't even have to free somebody else. But I think when you start to move free, you become an example for other people just by being free. And people think you have to do something. That is doing something.
It's doing something big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's so ironic because it could appear selfish. It could appear self-centered. How could you choose yourself? It's role modeling for everyone. I mean, when I read what you have gone through in getting up every morning at 4:30 and making your way across the city, across the bridge, into the prison, on the buses, and I just imagined, and then the depth of the work and the challenge of the work all day long, probably 5 days a week, like, I'm pretty sure I couldn't have handled that. I'm just reading it gave me like, whoa. So, you know, for any of us to get honest about what our little vessel is capable of and choose ourselves and then really live from that authentic place of self-love, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. And when you choose yourself like that, you aren't choosing yourself in a way that's individualistic. You're choosing yourself in a way that's interconnected, right? When you're choosing to do that level of deep soul work, that's not navel gazing, right? Because when you're doing that kind of work, it's active rather than just sitting there and contemplating everything and over intellectualizing it. Like, you're not doing that. And that's why I think metta is one of the most powerful practices that I've encountered, because it's about when I can't love myself or when I can't love people. Like, that's the real practice. It's not about offering the phrases. It's about what stops you from offering the phrases is the practice. And I don't think we say that clearly enough when we talk about metta. And I think that's why people think it's kind of like a throwaway practice. Oh yeah. You know, maybe safe, maybe happy, maybe healthy, maybe free, but no. But do you really mean that? Because if you don't, that's the thing you need to be thinking about.
Yeah. I mean, if you take that to the end game, you're looking at the person who maybe has done horrible things and choosing to love them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that person may be yourself.
Right. Oftentimes. Well, thank you for sharing your beautiful ability to write and share this with us. To me, this is one of the most precious books that I've read in a really, really long time. And I'm not just saying that to make you feel good, but I feel like, especially what's happening with all the ICE detention centers and the warehouses that have been bought, and it seems like they're going forward with many of these huge warehouses to incarcerate people. Like, this book is very, very timely, I think.
Yeah.
To really get clear about what's going on in those warehouses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as we started to believe that through our collective consciousness, we actually could say no.
Exactly.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. We can say no. I'm in New Jersey. They're saying no in Roxbury, New Jersey right now. So,
good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. We just all have to decide that we're willing to be inconvenienced, uncomfortable, risk some of our personal safety, maybe even.
Yep.
To say no.
Yep. And that we're stronger together.
Yeah. We're actually unbeatable together. Crazy thing to me is that we haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
I think over what you said, the individual, am I going to be okay? Instead of saying, are we going to be okay?
Yeah. And that's why, when you can begin with yourself and feel safe inside yourself, you can feel safe enough to be with other people. I think we feel so afraid all of the time that we're so stingy with what we can offer because we don't think there's enough for ourselves.
Yep. 100%. Well, by the time this interview airs, your book will be out and about for a little over a month.
Mm.
And I want people to come, I guess, to your website.
Yep.
www.onikamaze.com. And I'm going to spell that. It's O-N-E-I-K-A, Onika Maze, M-A-Y-S.com. And your book is called Sit With Me. And I love the subtitle, A No BS Journey to Mindfulness and Meditation. Beautiful colors. And so it looks like you can get them, you know, Target and Barnes and Noble, and some of the other book places that shall not be named.
Yep. And bookshop.org, thrift books.
Right.
Anywhere you buy your books, you'll be able to find it.
And I also see that you have a Let's Work Together on your website. What kind of work are you passionate about? What would you like to do?
I would like to sit with people. I'm doing retreats different places. I'm doing like a half day retreat at New York Insight. I speak to different people too, community groups. I do workshops at all different kinds of places. I've taught at places as big as Lincoln Center, as intimate as classrooms. So I would love to come sit with you and we can talk about this practice of loving kindness.
And do you have classes that you teach on a regular basis?
I haven't been teaching public classes lately, so it's mostly retreats, but you can find me at Kripalu. I'll be doing a retreat on forgiveness with my dear friend Jacoby Ballard. We'll be doing a whole retreat on forgiveness. And we'll be incorporating metta and movement, be at New York Insight, I think in July. They want to help me come back too.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Onika, for sharing yourself with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's really been a gift to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you, Onika Mays, for being with us today. And I just want to have a little call to action, which is to each one of us ask ourselves, what are one or two or three things that you can do to be part of the protest? To say, no, thank you. This is not happening on my watch. We can all do very, very small things. And some of you know an author named Timothy Snyder, and he has these rules that, you know, for dealing with really difficult times. And he says, don't pre-agree to the game that people are trying to play. Just say no. Just say no. No, thank you. Not doing that. Be disciplined. Be kind. And just stick to it and say, no, we're not doing that. Don't pre-agree to some game or the rules of the game that you don't want to be part of. And I think that's what Onika is doing with her book. So let's each think of little ways that we can resist and say no, thank you, politely, kindly, and not on my watch. Okay. Have a great week. We'll talk soon. A way that you can help support the Yoga Therapy Hour. Our Optimal State mobile app is available for both Android and iPhone. We've really simplified the check-in process, and it's a way to track your nervous system regulation, as well as your physical health and mental health. It can be part of your personal or professional practice. And by that, what we mean is that you might like to track your own nervous system, mental and physical health, and see the data for yourself, as well as receive interventions, do yoga nidras, breath work, meditation. All of it is on the app, and new content is being added all the time. But a second way you might like to use it is to recommend that your clients, your students, also use the app so that they can show you the data about their nervous system, about their mental and physical health. You can see where they've been in the weeks or months between the times that you meet with them as a practitioner. The app offers structured practices, self-assessment tools, and it's guided and rooted in yoga therapy and nervous system science. It's designed to help you track your state and begin to understand what shifts you and how to choose practices that will bring you back into balance. Whether you're using it for your own well-being or integrating it into the care for others that you offer, we'd love for you to come check it out and do the 3-week free trial. After that, it's about $5 a month. It's a tool that can support you and also the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Thanks for listening to this small way that you can support the Yoga Therapy Hour.
We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.